For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
1 Kings chapter 18, the 11th book in your Bible, if you want to take notes, follow along with us here. A little recap, pick up the flow of the story up until this point. If you remember correctly, when we started studying this book of 1 Kings, the nation of Israel was unified, powerful, coming under the authority of this new wise King Solomon. And by the end of Solomon's reign, because he had abandoned God, God decided to split this nation into two parts, a northern and a southern kingdom. And we saw that, it's talked some about the southern portion of Israel, but really here it's been focused on the northern kingdom. And we see that the northern kingdom has decided to worship Baal instead of God. Baal, a local deity, was actually the reason it had gained such popularity is because the king of Israel had married the princess from the nation to the north of Israel, Phoenicia, a woman named Jezebel, and she had brought with her Baal worship, and she was a very powerful, aggressive woman that got worship of Yahweh, the God of Israel. She made that illegal, began killing prophets, persecuting people that followed God, and they've abandoned God completely. And so what God did was God called for a drought, just like he said he would if they abandoned him. He said, I may need to stop the rain to get your attention. And that's what he does. And he sends Elijah, this prophet, this strange wanderer from this rough part of Israel, to confront the king. And he proclaims, there will be no rain until I let you know that God is going to send rain again. And so then he sends Elijah into hiding for 3+ years. Part of that is allowing the drought to really take effect. You know, a drought for a couple of weeks, nobody's really going to pay attention to that, but it's really starting to hurt after you get into a couple of years of no rain. Also, he's trying to protect Elijah, is partly why he sent him into hiding, and he's preparing Elijah for something greater, for an event that we'll see here tonight. So why don't we just pick up with where we left off last time. Elijah is in hiding up at Zarephath. He's just healed this woman's son. And it says, later on in the third year of the drought, the Lord said to Elijah, go and present yourself to King Ahab. Tell him that I will soon send rain. So God has now decided, I'm going to send rain. And he sends Elijah in to tell Ahab. This is not like Elijah was like, I think it's time for rain. God said, I think it's time for rain. Go tell him. So Elijah went to appear before King Ahab. Meanwhile, though, the famine had become very severe in Samaria, which was just another name for that northern kingdom. So Ahab summoned Obadiah, who was in charge of the palace. Now, this Obadiah character, he was a devoted follower of the Lord. You know, there's one time Jezebel had tried to kill the Lord's prophets, and Obadiah had hidden 100 of them in 2 caves. He put 50 prophets in each cave and supplied them with food and water. So this was, even though he was a high-ranking official in charge of the palace, he still was secretly loyal to God and was hiding. And you know, I mean, 100 prophets, that's a pretty significant operation, to hide 100 people and to feed them. And so he was pretty good at hiding stuff from Ahab. This seems like his specialty. Well, Ahab said to Obadiah, we must check every spring and valley in the land to see if we can find enough grass to save at least some of my horses and mules. And so there was nothing left in this land. If there's not enough grass for the king's livestock, there's no grass. This was really starting to hit Ahab where it hurt. He was in danger of losing his entire herd. So they divided the land between them. Ahab went one way by himself. Obadiah took another direction. And as Obadiah was walking along, he suddenly recognized Elijah coming toward him. He recognized him at once and bowed low to the ground. Is it really you, my Lord Elijah? He asked. Yes, it is, Elijah replied. Now go and tell your master, Elijah is here. Oh, sir, what harm have I done to you that you're sending me to my death at the hands of Ahab? I swear by the Lord your God, so he starts swearing, that the king has searched every nation and kingdom on earth from end to end to find you. Each time he was told, Elijah isn't here. And Ahab forced the king of that nation to swear to the truth of his claim. So Ahab apparently thought that the reason this drought has come, he ignored all of the spiritual warnings that Elijah had given. He just thought Elijah was some kind of shaman who had conjured up or had said the right magic words to get Yahweh to put a curse on the land to send a drought. And instead of turning back to God and leading the people that way, he spent all his time hunting him down. Elijah was like, you know, Osama bin Laden, where he was viewed as a terrorist, a bringer of problems to the land, and he must be sought out and destroyed, and then our lives will go back to normal. And he's like, and now you say, go and tell your master Elijah's here? As soon as I leave, the Spirit of the Lord will carry you away to who knows where. When Ahab comes and cannot find you, he's going to kill me. Yet I've been a true servant of the Lord all my life. Has no one told you, my Lord, about the time when Jezebel was trying to kill the Lord's prophets? I hid 100 of them in 2 caves and supplied them with food and water. And Elijah's like, yes, the narrator mentioned that several verses ago. I know about that. And now you say, go and tell your master Elijah's here. Sure, if I do that, Ahab will certainly kill me. And so he's repeating himself. He's like, I don't want to die. Please don't make me tell him. I mean, it's like, I'm good at hiding stuff from Ahab, not telling stuff to Ahab. But Elijah said, I swear by the Lord Almighty, in whose presence I stand, that I will present myself to Ahab this very day. So he went to tell Ahab Elijah had come, and Ahab went out to meet Elijah. When Ahab saw him, he exclaimed, so, it is really you, you troublemaker of Israel, with a sneer. I have made no trouble for Israel, Elijah replied. You and your family are the troublemakers. You've refused to obey the commands of the Lord and have worshipped images of Baal instead. He says, I know you are, but what am I? Don't you understand the reason why this whole thing came? This was not me making trouble. This was me. I'm just the delivery boy here. I just showed up to tell you what God said about how screwed up your leadership is and how messed up spiritually this whole nation is. The point was, turn back to God. That's why he did this. And now you think the problem is me, and if you just kill me, it'll all go away? No way. Elijah hadn't learned a thing this whole time. He was in pain. He wanted the famine to go away. He wanted the rain to come back. But spiritually, it was like it was just bouncing off the surface. And Elijah's like, you know, he realizes if he just tells Ahab the rain's coming back, there's a good chance Ahab would give Baal credit for that and have Elijah killed. And he says, I want you to do this. I want you to summon all Israel to join me at Mount Carmel, along with the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah, who are supported by Jezebel. So he says, I want you to get everybody, and we're going to have a meeting. And I want you to bring all 850 prophets that are on staff that you feed every day out of the, your people are starving to death, and you're feeding 850 prophets of this false god, which is why we're in a famine in the first place. Let's get everybody together, and let's just settle this once and for all. And I want you to do, let's meet at Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel. Just to get a little sense of the geography here, I showed you this map last week. This is a map of all of Israel. We zoomed in on the northern part here and saw Elijah's journey last week from Samaria north to the brook of Cherith and then even farther north to Zarephath up in Jezebel's home country. Well, Mount Carmel, you can see it's back down here right near the coast. Mount Carmel was right on the border between Phoenicia and Israel. And so, you know, it's possible he was doing it there because he wanted people from Phoenicia. He wanted Sidonians to come if they wanted to. This was supposedly the home of Baal. This was the mountain where Baal resided. So Elijah was giving them home court advantage here. He's like, well, let's do this on your territory. That way you don't have any excuses. If you zoom in a little bit more on this Mount Carmel area, you can see this is a view from space of Mount Carmel. It's really not just a single mountain, but you can see this entire mountain range. It's a long ridge. That's about 12 miles long there. And at the northwestern point, it looks out over into the sea. It's not really clear where exactly on Mount Carmel this took place. There's like a church that's kind of more southeast portion of this ridge. It probably wasn't there, though, because later in the narrative, we see that they went up on the mountain a little bit higher, and they were able to see the ocean. You can't see the ocean at all from there. It was probably more in the northwestern portion, the part overlooking the sea and the plain in that area. You can see also there's kind of ridges and little dips and craters. They probably picked one of these concave portions at the top of the mountain, because what that would allow them to do is get thousands of people packed up on the hillside, kind of amphitheater style. So the acoustics would have been pretty decent, and as many people as possible could have shown up to witness this showdown. And so here they are. Ahab summoned all the people of Israel and the prophets to Mount Carmel. So the big day arrives. They selected a certain day. They sent word throughout the land. And people showed up. It appears that there were literally thousands of people at this. They would have left very early in the morning just to begin the trek up the mountain so they can get there by sunrise, which is roughly when the festivities were going to start. And Elijah speaks first, and Elijah stood in front of the people, and he said, "How much longer will you waver, hobbling between two opinions? You go to Baal, you go to Yahweh, you go to Baal, you go to Yahweh. You're limping, you're hobbling back and forth like a crippled person. How long are you going to do this?" He says, "If the Lord is God, follow Him. If Baal is God, follow him." It's a good point. If the Lord is really God, then why don't we follow him? And if Baal is really God, let's follow him. Let's stop trying to do both. That really doesn't make any sense at all, does it? You can imagine someone in the audience sitting here. You've showed up. You're starving to death. You may have lost loved ones, family members, people close to you to this drought, this famine. And you really don't know what to expect. You're really just hoping that you'll see something supernatural, and really, honestly, you're hoping there'll be some rain sometime soon, and maybe this God duel is going to bring that about. And, there would have been a pretty wide range of people in this audience. There might be some people that had never really even heard about Yahweh, this God that Elijah is talking about. It might have been pretty intriguing. They'd maybe heard some things about the God of the Israelites. Maybe some people came down from Phoenicia to see this event. There might be some people that had never even heard of him. They didn't know much about him. There might be some people that, their apostasy, their abandonment of God was not really an intentional thing. It was just kind of like, well, it was just a passive thing. Slowly but surely, they just stopped, reading whatever copy they had of God's Word. They started practicing some of the other things that the people around them were practicing. It really might not have even been on their radar. It might have been something that just kind of they slipped into. You might have had the person that consciously knew, "I'm supposed to worship God alone, and yet I'm really screwed if there's no rain this year. And so, in addition to worshiping God, why not worship Baal as well? Why not try and make both gods happy?" And so they're going over here and doing this, and then they're kind of coming over here and doing this thing with God, and they're coming over here and doing this thing with Baal, and they just figure it can't hurt. I'm worshiping both. There also is probably the person that had intentionally rejected Yahweh and worship of him and was just serving and worshiping Baal. But the message is the same for all of them. If God is really God, if Yahweh is really God, then let's follow him. And if not, then follow the other guy. And hopefully, this morning and this afternoon, we'll have a definitive answer on this. So what's it going to be, people? What is it going to be? And the people were completely silent. You could have heard a pin drop on that mountaintop. Because the people, they didn't know what to say. And so they just didn't say anything. Passive people, spiritually passive people of Israel. Not enough backbone to stand up and make a choice one way or the other. And you know, God might be saying the same thing to you tonight. If the Lord is God, then why don't you follow him? Really. If he's the all-powerful God, if he is loving, perfectly loving like he claims to be, if he's good, then what is your hesitation? What are you so afraid of? What are you afraid to give your life, to give your heart over to this God? What are you afraid that he's going to do to you? When has he ever failed you? When has he ever let you down? What good are your other gods doing you? Your God of comfort, your God of relationships, your girlfriend God, your boyfriend God, your spouse God, your money God. Are those really coming through for you? The other religion that you're a part of? The other God you worship? Is that really working out? If that's really God, then why don't you just go for it all the way? Instead of just vacillating, hobbling, limping between all of your different gods, further crippling yourself in the process. And the people were completely silent. They needed to see more. And so Elijah said to them, I am the only prophet of the Lord who is left, but Baal has 450 prophets. Well, he wasn't the only prophet. He knew there were some prophets hidden in caves. But as far as this competition was concerned, he's the only one that showed up. Bring two bulls. Prophets of Baal may choose whichever one they wish, cut it in pieces, and lay on the wood of their altar, but without setting fire to it. I'll prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood on the altar, but not set fire to it. And so he's like, okay, you guys get to pick the bull. We're on your home field. We're trying to set everything in favor of the Baal worshippers. Then you call the name of your God, and I'll call the name of the Lord. The God who answers by setting fire to wood is the true God. And all the people agree. They said, that sounds like a good idea. So the people answer here. Prophets of Baal really didn't get a say in this. They're kind of stuck with, these are the terms of the duel. So they're like, okay, I guess we better go at this. Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, you go first, for there's many of you. Choose one of the bulls, prepare it, call on the name of your God, but do not set fire to the wood. So he lets them go first as well, which also would have been a disadvantage, because you think about it, if Baal actually showed up and set fire to that that sacrifice, you think Elijah would even get a chance for Yahweh to respond? No way. Elijah would have been the very next sacrifice on that altar if there was any response here. I mean, this was like sudden death in the literal sense of the term. First score wins. So they prepared one of the bulls and placed it on the altar, and they called on the name of Baal from morning until noontime, shouting, oh, Baal, answer us! That's like 9 to noon, 3 hours. Oh, Baal, answer us! 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 It doesn't take 3 hours to say, oh, Baal, answer us. I mean, this was 850 prophets, the 450 of Baal plus the other 400 that showed up, chanting this or some variant of this for close to 3 hours. I mean, this might have been pretty exciting and impressive at first as they all lined up. They all had these, you know, these chants. They had them down. They practiced these. This was part of their worship. This was their ritual. And as they started chanting, there may have been a sense of anticipation, like, Baal, he's going to show up. This is going to be awesome. We've got every single prophet of Baal here, all the professionals. I mean, this is like an all-star team here. I mean, anybody who was good at summoning or conjuring Baal would have been here. And surely, with this volume of magic words, Baal's got to show up. I mean, they must have said hundreds of thousands, I bet, of words over the course of this morning. Oh, Baal, answer us. And, you know, this is really actually pretty common to just chant prayers, to chant statements to the God or gods. You know, when people make up a religion, this is often a part of it. Repetition of words. And the thought is that if they say these words enough, then the God will hear them. And if they say them just the right way, then the God is going to be forced to respond. It's like they've kind of, you know, nailed the Achilles heel. And the God has no choice, but it's just kind of, you know, his arm is twisted behind his back. And eventually he has to pour out his supernatural power for whatever the worshiper wants him to do. Jesus talked about this. He says, when you're praying, do not use meaningless repetition as the Gentiles do. They suppose that they'll be heard for their many words. They think that the logic is just sheer volume of words, and eventually the devoutness of the worshiper, the religious fervency, that's going to force the God to do what the worshiper wants him to do. I mean, this is really the notion of magic. If I know the incantation, if I know the magic words, then the God is putty in my hands. And for even if it's just for a little while, I can get him or her or them to do my bidding. It's me forcing myself onto the God. And this Baal was just like a lot of religions in this way. You know, I mean, and even today, you could go around the world and you could see that pretty much every religion has their own chants, their own prayers that you say repeatedly. You know, even in some branches of Christianity, if you mess up, you just show up and you say this particular prayer 10 times, and you know, then the God is required to forgive you, or let you off the hook, whatever. And you know, Christ says that's not true at all. I mean, it's ironic, this Matthew 6 passage. Jesus goes on to say, when you pray, pray like this: Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. He goes on to pray what is known today as the Lord's Prayer. And sadly, the Lord's Prayer, probably more than any other prayer in the history of humankind, has become meaningless repetition. It's been chanted and repeated so many times, and is zoned out. And, you know, I mean, sometimes people are probably thinking about this, but for the most part, this is it's a magic prayer that you say to get something from God. And Jesus spoke directly against this in the context where that prayer was given. And this is what the prophets of Baal were doing. They were chanting their chants, saying their magic incantations. But there was no reply of any kind. In spite of all of the energy, the emotion that they threw into this, nothing. Dead silence. As an hour goes by, 2 hours go by. Well, at a certain point, it says, then they danced, hobbling around the altar they had made. And so they went into their, you know, often accompanying the magic words, you've got magic motions, gestures, hand motions, head motions, things you're supposed to dance, things you're supposed to do. And these are all part of what, you know, what one author calls the gestures of approach, where you've got to do certain things in order to enter the presence of the holy, or in order to get the God to do, again, what you want him to do, to harness the power of the gods. You could go around the world, and just like the magic words, you could have, you know, in every religion, they've got their things. You swing, you bang, you twirl, gestures you make with your hands, your head, your eyes, your feet, your upper body, no matter, you know, it comes in all different shapes and sizes, but the core is pretty similar. The core principle there. And the Baal cult was the same way. Dancing, hobbling around this altar they had made. So it was kind of a dance and kind of like a limp that they would do, apparently. All morning long. And there's nothing. And Elijah, you know, maybe there's a part of him that was like, man, I hope there's no fire. But part of this, he knows. He knows that there's no Baal. He knows that God is the only God. And he knows that God has called on him to do this, so he's got nothing to worry about. And at about noon, Elijah, he wants to make sure that nobody is able to make any excuses for why Baal doesn't show up. He begins mocking them about noon. He says, you'll have to shout a little louder, for surely he is a God. I'm sure he's there. I'm sure he's really a God. Why don't you just go a little louder? Maybe he just can't hear you. Perhaps he's daydreaming or is relieving himself. And I think I saw him head that way with a magazine. Maybe he's away on a trip or is asleep and needs to be awakened. You know, that Baal's a deep sleeper. Just keep ringing the doorbell. I'm sure he'll get up eventually. I think he might be out of town. Maybe if you shout louder, wherever he is in the netherworld, he can hear you. And these would have all been things that their gods would have had to do. And you can read the myths about these gods. These are the things they're doing. And so, you know, when humans make up gods, they're really just like overgrown humans with the same limitations. They're not infinite. They're not like the God of the Bible. That's just not the kind of thing we think of. And so Elijah is just mocking them in front of all the people to show the people, this is the lie you're worshiping. This is the lie that you believe. This is how weak and impotent your God is. You've got everybody here, and he can't do a simple task like lighting a fire. I can light a fire, and Baal can't light a fire? Come on. It took the bait. They shouted louder. And following their normal custom, they began cutting themselves with knives and swords until the blood gushed out. This is the next step that often comes with religion. I need to hurt myself. My words aren't working. My actions aren't working. Maybe if I hurt myself, then they'll see I'm serious. And this was their custom. They began cutting themselves, one another, with swords and knives, chopping themselves. And not just like, you know, like a little cut on the hair or something like that. I mean, we're talking blood was gushing here. There was probably people passing out at a certain point after chanting and shouting all morning. And then the cutting, the slicing of one another. I mean, it makes sense from a religion perspective that this is going to gain me some kind of merit. In Colossians 2, Paul's talking about this harsh treatment of the body. He's like, you know, such regulations, they have an appearance of wisdom. Their self-imposed worship, their false humility, their harsh treatment of the body, but in the end, they lack any value in restraining sensual indulgence. So if you think, well, you know, I just, my thought life is horrible. I keep thinking about things I shouldn't think about. I keep doing things I shouldn't do. Maybe I should just beat myself up, and that'll be what will really show God that I'm serious, and then God will help me. Or this will tear me down so that I really follow God. And he's like, you know, it seems like it would work, but it actually doesn't at all. That's just made up by, those are man-made regulations. They lack any value in the spiritual realm. And so the Baal worshipers, they just continue to pour more energy. There's so much coming from the human side in this prayer session. They go on and on. All afternoon, it says that they raved until the time of the evening sacrifice, which was about 3 o'clock. But there was still no sound, no reply, no response. Nothing. Nothing but crickets chirping and the screams and shrieks of Baal prophets. I wonder why Baal didn't show up. I wonder, maybe he was on vacation. Maybe he was really going to the bathroom. Maybe he was just asleep. Maybe he was daydreaming. Maybe he was distracted. Or maybe it's the first thing Elijah said, that Baal isn't even a god. And sadly, sincerity is not enough. You know, if anybody was sincere in the history of sincerity, it was these guys. They were so sincere, they believed this so strongly, they worked at this so hard just to get Baal to show up. And the reason Baal didn't show up was not because they didn't try or work hard enough. The reason Baal didn't show up is because, sadly, there is no Baal. He was never going to show up, no matter how sincere they were. And this is a pretty important point here, that when we go to pray, really our sincerity, the amount of belief that we have is really not that big of a factor. Jesus said, really, the amount of faith you need is pretty small, like the smallest thing you can imagine. That's about how much faith you need. The real question is, where do you place your faith? Is it in something that's true or something that's false? Something that's a lie, something that's made up, or something that is actually there? And the worshipers, this whole project was doomed from the beginning, because there's no such thing as Baal. And that was what Elijah was trying to prove to the people. That's what God was trying to prove to the people, and that's why he set this whole thing up. And so, nothing. The prophets of Baal had failed. And probably while they were still going, Elijah's like, you know, all right, you guys have seen enough. He called to the people, come over here. And they all gathered in as close as they could. As he knelt down and began to repair the altar of the Lord there on the mountain that had maybe been used before the temple had fallen into disrepair, he begins to put this back together. He took 12 stones, one to represent each of the tribes of Israel. Yeah, the nation was divided, but he's reminding them of the nation that God promised them, reminding them of their past, their roots. And he used the stones to rebuild the altar in the name of the Lord. And then he begins digging a trench around this altar. And it says that he dug this trench. It was large enough to hold about 3 gallons. Okay, so not a real deep trench, but enough to hold about 3 gallons. And he piled wood on the altar. He begins piling it on. He cuts the bull into pieces, and he laid the pieces on the altar. You know, the feel here is very calm, very intentional. As the people watch him prepare this, there's none of the dancing. There's none of the cutting. There's none of the shouting or shrieking or screaming. There's just the intentional focus of a man who knows that he's doing the will of the Lord. And he said, I want you to fill 4 large jars with water and pour that water over the offering in the wood. And so he sends 4 guys. You know, they might have run down all the way to the ocean to get this. They might have found a spring somewhere on the mountain. It's probably salt water. After they had done this, he said, do it again. And when they were finished, he said, now do it a 3rd time. So they did as he said. What's he doing here? He's stacking the deck against himself. To the point where there's standing water in the trench. In the dry parched trench, there's standing water. There's water on the altar. The wood is soaked. The animal is soaked. And the water ran around the altar, even filled the trench. This was a substantial amount of water. And at the usual time for offering the evening sacrifice, the prophets of Baal are continuing to chant in the background. Elijah the prophet walked up to the altar and prayed. Again, there's no magic dance. There's no magic words. He didn't cut himself up before doing this. He just walked up and started praying. And here's what he said. He said, oh Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, prove today that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant. Prove that I have done all this at your command. And so he starts off, he calls God the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. He's reminding them, you know, we never should have been a nation in the first place. We were one guy, couldn't have any kids. God took that guy and promised him, I'm going to make you a great nation. Just because I decided to do that. And he kept every promise he made to Abraham. And then he kept every promise he made to Abraham's son Isaac. And every promise he made to Jacob. And every single one of their descendants after that. God is the living God who works and acts in history. Who keeps his promises. And who's the only God who's ever given us anything as a nation. And he's the only God that's worth following. And he says, just prove that you're God. And that I'm your servant, you know. It's not like Baal, where Baal's their servant. And the prophets are telling Baal what to do. He's just like, just show him that I'm your servant. And I just did this, like he says, prove that I've done this all at your command. And so who's calling the shots here? It's God. Elijah's just his servant. This is a very simple prayer. He says, oh Lord, answer me. Answer me so these people will know that you, O Lord, are God and that you have brought them back to yourself. And so he's like, just answer me, you know, not for my sake. Answer me for their sake. All the people watching. So they will know that you're God and that you have brought them back to yourself. I mean, the prayer of Elijah here, it's so simple. It's so short, it couldn't take him more than 20, 30 seconds to pray that. Notice how relational it is. I mean, he's not chanting at God. He's not trying to strong-arm God into doing something. He's just talking to God like somebody talks to somebody they love. And he's saying, you know, remember we talked about this? You said, you know, Why don't you do that? Why don't you show these people what you're really like? And it's so humble and submissive too. He's just like, you know, you're God. He's drawing on the promises of God and just asking God to show up and do what God said he was going to do. There's so little coming from Elijah's side, especially in contrast with the prophets of Baal. And the result is so different. Whereas Baal answered nothing, Elijah's simple prayer unleashed the power of God. And all you heard was, and when the people looked, there was no wood, there was no meat. In fact, there were no stones, water, or even dust. All that was left was a blackened crater with a little bit of smoke coming off of it, where that altar used to stand. God showed up and sent fire from heaven right in the moment of truth, right when he had to do it, at the prayer of Elijah. It says, immediately the fire of the Lord flashed down from heaven and burned up the young bull, the wood, the stones, the dust, and all the water in the trench. Now, I mean, I've seen meat and wood burn, but I've never seen stones be consumed by fire. I've never seen dust get burned up. This was supernatural. This was not a fire that a human made. This was fire from God. Right? Just like God said he was going to do. I mean, you can imagine Elijah, he had to be a little bit scared to see that fire show up. I'd have been breathing pretty hard at that point. Thrilled that God came through. I can't believe what I just saw. And when all the people saw it, they fell face down on the ground and they cried out, "The Lord, he is God." Yes, the Lord is God. So the people finally answer Elijah's question. Which one's God? And the people are like, obviously, Yahweh is God. And then Elijah, it doesn't end there. Elijah commanded them, seize all the prophets of Baal. Don't let a single one escape. And then the people seized them all, and Elijah then took them down to the Kishon Valley and killed them there. So they executed 850 prophets of Baal. Well, that's pretty disturbing. That's pretty gruesome. I don't know if that bothers you. That bothers me, reading about that. What we're seeing here is the judgment of God. God, this is part of God's character. God doesn't just accept everybody. God cares too much just to let evil go unpunished. And so this is, God said, you know, you need to execute these people. They've committed capital crimes, and what they've done is worthy of death. Everyone has seen it. We've got plenty of witnesses here, and it's time to carry out the death sentence on these men and maybe women. Now, a couple things that might shed a little bit of perspective on this. For one, these guys would have gotten the same sentence in a 21st century United States court. Every single one of them had committed more than enough to convict them of deserving the death penalty. If you remember, the worship of Baal involved human sacrifice. Each of these priests had probably executed many, many children, all in vain, for a god that wasn't even there. Also, they had almost certainly committed rape as part of these sexual rites, and even worse, had probably arranged for thousands of rapes. If this sex thing was part of their worship. And so what they had done, actually, even by our standards today, that would be enough to convict them. But in addition, in Israel, leading people astray spiritually was also a capital crime. It was worthy of death. And if you think about it, if you really believe in the God of the Bible, there's a lot worse things that you can do to somebody than to shorten their physical life. If someone is killed, executed, if you're chopping, a few years, maybe a few decades at most off of their life. But spiritually, if you lead someone astray spiritually, into spiritual death, that's eternal. That's permanent. That's much worse than physical death. Spiritual death, Jesus says, don't fear the one that can destroy the body. Fear the one that can destroy the soul. That's a lot worse. He said, you know, if you lead one of these little ones astray, he said, it's going to be better for you that they take a giant stone and tie it around your neck and throw you in the ocean. Because what I'm going to do to you is nothing compared to that. That's nothing compared to how mad Christ would be about that. And so these men had led Israel astray. And God says the consequences have been disastrous. How many innocent people have you guys killed? And now he had to judge them. And so as disturbing as this is there, this is the judgment of God on these people. And this was executed that day. And so they took him down and they killed these prophets. And then Elijah said to Ahab, go and get something to eat and drink, for I hear a mighty rainstorm coming. You know, it wasn't like there was thunder yet. Nobody else heard this. It was still a clear sky. But he says, why don't you go get something to eat? And I think there's rain on the way. So Ahab, he went to eat and drink and probably tried to figure out how he's going to break this to his wife. Very scary woman. But Elijah, he actually climbed back up to the top of Mount Carmel and he bowed low to the ground and he prayed with his face between his knees. So he goes back to prayer again. Begins talking to God. And he said to his servant, go out and look toward the sea. So the servant went and looked and he returned to Elijah and said, I didn't see anything. Nothing there. Elijah's like, well, go again. Nothing. Go again. Nothing. Go again, nothing. I mean, these storms, they rolled in from the west, and his servant continues to see nothing seven times. And Elijah, you know, at some point, he's got to be wondering here, boy, God, did I hear you right about that rain thing? He's got to be wondering if God is going to come through, and he keeps sending his servant back up there. Now, at this point, this might be a little bit confusing here, because we said on the one hand that, you know, the pagan religions, they use meaningless repetition. Religion in general uses meaningless repetition. And this, on the surface, it looks like meaningless repetition. Just do it over and over and over again until the rain comes. But there is a difference between meaningless repetition, on the one hand, and persistence in prayer, on the other hand. I mean, one big difference is, with meaningless repetition, you're trying to wear down the God. It's intended to have some effect on your God that you're praying to. Whereas with persistence in prayer, the effect is on us. It stretches our faith. We're forced to wait for God's answer. There's a tension between what God has promised and what we're praying and what is actually happening. And so, you know, with persistence in prayer, it works on us. It's really one of the primary differences here. Also, with meaningless repetition, a lot of times you're trying to get your will forced upon God, whereas with persistence in prayer, you're still praying the word and the will of God. You're praying in accordance with the will of God. That's an important qualification that's got to be made on our prayers. And so you're not just making things up and trying to force on them, but you're just saying, God, you said that you would do this, you promised this, let's see this here. And then you wait for God to show up. And you know, from what I've seen, if I pray once and something happens, I mean, that's cool. But it's more when I prayed and prayed and prayed and it doesn't seem to be happening and I continue to cling to the promises of God. And then it happens. That's where my faith is taken to a new level. That's where I become a little bit tougher spiritually. My eyes of faith get a little sharper. And so finally, on the seventh time, his servants told him, I saw a little cloud about the size of a man's hand rising from the sea. So pretty small, you know, like that big off in the distance. And Elijah gets real excited. He shouts, hurry to Ahab and tell him, climb in your chariot and go back home. If you don't hurry, the rain will stop you. That storm is coming quick. And soon the sky was black with clouds and a heavy wind brought a terrific rainstorm. And Ahab left quickly for Jezreel, his home city. And then the Lord gave special strength to Elijah. He tucked his cloak into his belt And he ran ahead of Ahab's chariot all the way to the entrance of Jezreel. A little bit weird. Tucks his robe into his underwear and just starts running. This may have been 15 to 20 miles, maybe 30 miles, depending on where he's at on that mountain range. You know, maybe Elijah's chariot had trouble with mud or something like that. I don't know. But regardless, this guy, I mean, he was on such a spiritual high, and he was empowered by the Spirit of God that he just runs as fast as he can, you know, down the mountain and then right on down into the capital city there. No doubt thinking, we're going to go back and we're going to have a triumphal parade. That worship of Yahweh has been restored to the land. I'm sure that's what will happen, thinks Elijah. And he runs all the way there. Well, next week we'll see what actually happens when he gets back to Jezreel. That story is too long for tonight. You can read it if you want. I mean, it's not like I'm making this stuff up each week. Let's think a little bit about, though, what we've learned here. Just two points of summary. One, you know, biblical prayer, it's simple, it's relational, it's based on truth. It's not that we're making things up, we're bullying God around to do what we want him to do. It's not that we've got to cut ourselves and cry and scream and wear, you know, calluses into our knees and just, you know, work up all this human energy to force God to do something we want him to do. It's very simple and straightforward. I mean, we might get calluses on our knees, but it's not because we're there repeating the same thing over and over and over again. Probably because we're talking to God about a lot of different things. It's based on truth. I love this verse in James chapter 5. You know, it's easy to think, Elijah, man, boy, this is like, you know, superhero stuff. There's no way. There's no way I could be like Elijah. He was something different than me. James says, no, not so, my friend. He says, Elijah was human just like us. And yet, when he prayed earnestly that no rain would fall, none fell for 3.5 years. It's interesting because it's translated prayed earnestly, but if you look at the footnote, it actually says he prayed with prayer. And, you know, some people think that just is a way to say he just prayed really hard, but there's other commentators, which I tend to agree with, that just would argue that all he's saying is, the guy just prayed. He prayed using prayer and nothing else. And none fell for 3.5 years. It goes on to say he prayed again that it would rain, and it did. And so the tone in this passage is it's pretty simple. He just prayed with prayer. Imagine that. And God answered. And the reason was because he prayed according to the word of God. He prayed according to the will of God. And prayer, in a sense, it's just this cool relational thing where we're talking to God, we're gaining his perspective, and we're talking to him about his perspective, his will, and his promises. And Elijah, he's just like you guys, just like me. And so the great things that God did through him, that's totally possible through anybody here. Don't ever think that I'm destined to a life of mediocrity. I can never do anything significant for God. God says, I've got plans for every single person that wants to come to me. There's work to be done. And, you know, things that might seem small in your eyes, they're actually, you have no idea what I'm doing. And it actually is pretty significant. And ultimately, he's prepared works before he ever created the world. He prepared stuff for you to do. Significant things. And if you're willing just to turn to him in prayer and talk to him about the direction that he wants you to take, to look in his word and to pray through that, you'd be surprised at what God can do through a man like you, a woman like you, a woman and man just like Elijah. And ultimately, if the Lord is God, then follow him. That really comes through in this narrative here. You know, I mean, you've got certainly God's superiority shining all through this thing. But, you know, repeated throughout is, what are you guys going to do? Who are you going to follow? Are you going to follow the God who is there, the living God, the God who is superior to all of the other false gods that we make up, the God who is superior to any other spiritual power who's out there, choose this day who you're going to follow. Stop vacillating. Stop limping around to your different gods, limping from these different opinions, these different things that you worship, that you devote your life to. They're never going to satisfy you. And if you're here tonight and you've never even met this God, maybe some of this stuff is totally new to you. The fact that there's a God there. The fact that there's a God who's initiating with you. Like Elijah said, he said, answer this prayer so that the people will know that you have turned their heart back to yourself. God is the one taking that initiative. And God has taken that initiative with you through the person of Jesus Christ. You see, God loves you. God wants to relate to you. God wants you to develop this kind of a prayer life that we're talking about. And the first step in that is to admit, God, I deserve death. I deserve to die for the wrongs that I've committed. I haven't met your standard. I've loved other gods. I've loved other things more than you. I've broken our relationship. That's something that should have been reserved for you alone. And I've really tried to be my own God. And I'm wrong. I need your forgiveness. And to admit to that and to ask him to come into your life, to ask the Spirit of God to come down and make his home in your heart, that's the offer that God is extending to you here tonight. And if you haven't done that, I urge you to do that. And there we've got 1 Kings 18. Well, let's pray. Yeah, God, your glory just shines through this story here. To see how powerful you are. To see your concern for the people. To turn back to you. And I thank you for that. I thank you that our relationship with you is not a matter, is not something that you hate or are reluctant to do and we've got to force you into it, God, but you're eager to. And it's a simple relational thing to come and talk to you. I pray, God, that we would believe you, that we believe that you are God, and that we would stop vacillating between this and that. It's so easy to slip into that, Lord. And I pray that we would turn and follow you wholeheartedly. I pray, too, God, for anybody here that doesn't know you, that they'd be willing to turn to you finally, God, and admit that the other things in their life are not getting it done, and that you're true, and you're truly there. And that they would invite you into their life and receive your forgiveness. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.